As we continue in our examination of early church history, we're kind of beginning to come out of the early church period, and this particular lecture will be something of a transitional lecture. I'll be dealing with some things that I think properly belong to the early church period, but then some things a little bit beyond, because what I want to focus on in this brief lecture is the story of the Egyptian and Ethiopian church in their origins. Basically, what I'm talking about is African Christianity in the first 5 centuries, or at least mainly as it was in the eastern part of Africa. Again, I'm talking about Egypt and Ethiopia. I'll make a little bit of mention to the West, but we've talked about that already previously. In the early church period and beyond, the continent of Africa played an important role in the history of the church. The biggest influence came from the large and influential Christian community in North Africa, but then also in Egypt. We don't have a lot of concrete evidence for how Christianity came to Egypt. According to tradition, the gospel author Mark was the first one to go to Egypt to preach the gospel. Again, we don't have a lot of firm history on that, but that's a tradition at least. We also know that Apollos, that early and eloquent missionary, was an Alexandrian Jew, according to the book of Acts. But we have no idea if he acquired his Christian faith at Alexandria. Now, certainly, there was a large Jewish population in Alexandria and many other Egyptian cities, so there was an opportunity for Christianity, understood as an offshoot of Judaism, to spread there. I mean, in other words, when you have the great multitude assembled on the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2, hearing Peter preach, pilgrims who had come from all over the Roman Empire and perhaps beyond to listen, to be a part of Pentecost, that great feast, and they heard Peter preach, and 3,000 men of them became Christians, were converted that day. It's likely that surely some of them were from Alexandria because it was a large Jewish center outside of Judea and Galilee. According to one of my favorite church historians, you've heard me mention him before, Kenneth Scott Latterett, in volume 1 of his work, A History of the Expansion of Christianity, he makes this statement about the spread of the gospel to Egypt. Latterett says, "By the end of the 2nd century, the church was already strong. There had been a gospel according to the Egyptians, and several strains of Christianity were represented, including some of which the mainstream regarded as heretical. In Alexandria itself, a famous catechetical school developed, which was to have among its teachers such distinguished scholars as Clement and Origen. In Alexandria, the Christianity was predominantly Greek. Before the time of Constantine, however, it had spread elsewhere in Egypt and among the indigenous populations. Translations of parts of the scriptures had possibly been made into more than one dialect of the non-Greek vernacular, and the faith was found in Upper as well as Lower Egypt, and the foundations of a native Egyptian or Coptic church had been laid." Again, I'm fascinated by this observation of Latterett. He's telling us that Christianity mainly began among the Greek-speaking and Greek-cultured population of Alexandria. You know, when we think of Egypt, we think of the great pharaohs of the past, and we think of the pyramids and the Sphinx, and we think of the hieroglyphics and this great ancient Egyptian society. And of course, that influence lived on into the days of Bible times and then following into the early church period. But there was also a very strong Greek presence from the colonization from Rome, prior to that as well, the colonial influence under the successors of Alexander the Great. So there was a very sizable and important, you could even say dominant, Greek presence and Greek cultural presence there. But there was also the native, so to speak, presence. People who came from that part of the world, descendants of the original Egyptians, so to speak. And what Lateret is telling us is not only was Christianity thriving among the more Greek-cultured and speaking population of Egypt, but also among the native population, the gospel began to spread, churches were planted, scriptures were translated among that Egyptian, or you could also call it the Coptic population. Again, that's the native-born, so to speak, Egyptian cultural group. Lateret continues here on his observations. He says this, when Christianity began to win numerous adherents among the Egyptian-using population, the need was felt for a Christian literature which could be used by them. In place of the difficult hieroglyphics, a simple script was employed based largely on Greek letters. The Egyptian so written was called Coptic. The chief home of Coptic Christian literature was in Upper Egypt, or the Thebaid, and the dialect which prevailed there was known as Saidic. Translations into it were made from the Greek. That of the Bible seems to have been completed about AD 350. Most of this Coptic Christian literature appears to have been the work of monks who were so prominent in Egypt. They were the educated class. So again, I think it's fascinating that Christianity in Egypt really began among the Jewish and Greek cultural elements there. These were the people who were the leaders in the great schools, the great universities of Alexandria. You know, these would have been the people influenced by the people like Clement and Athanasius and Origen and those folks. But then there was also a very distinct penetration of the gospel into the traditional Egyptian peoples and cultures, so much so that Christianity was at least in part responsible for the development of the Coptic language. Again, they kept the Egyptian language, at least in a lot of its basis, but then they, in its written form, they moved away from hieroglyphics and they came to the place where they used an alphabet that was very much like the Greek alphabet. And so, what we find is that for all the strength of Christianity in Egypt, the presence of the Christian faith was far stronger west of Egypt in North Africa, especially in the region in and around ancient Carthage. That's present Tunisia and Algeria, again, up on the northern coast, northwestern coast of the continent of Africa. Christianity was very strong in this region by the time of Constantine. Indeed, you could say that the strongest concentration of Christian influence in the Roman Empire was first the area that we call Asia Minor. That's the area of modern-day Turkey. But then the second greatest area of Christian influence and strength in the Roman Empire would be this area of North Africa, what is today modern-day Tunisia and Algeria. This had a huge number of Christians and a very strong presence there. Now, late in the 3rd century, there arose a terrible persecution against the largely Coptic Christians of Egypt. By this time, the Coptic church had really grown in its influence and strength. And because, of course, that area of the Egyptian area, Alexandria, Egypt, all the rest of it, was under Roman domination, when there arose widespread Roman persecution, it was the Coptic Christians of Egypt who suffered greatly under this. The church historian Eusebius of Caesarea was in Upper Egypt during that final episode of persecution that was ordered by the emperor Maximian in the year 311. Eusebius said that so many Christians were beheaded that the axe used to cut off their heads was made dull and that it eventually broke, and the executioners themselves were exhausted by all their labor of cutting off heads. Yet, he said as well, as soon as one of these Egyptian believers was killed, someone else would confess themselves to be a Christian and be sent to their death. And often they would be sent to their death singing psalms and hymns. Coptic Christians in Egypt still remember those days. They date their era from the ascension of Diocletian in 284 as a permanent reminder of their eventual triumph over this very severe Roman persecution. Now, over the centuries, the Islamic invasion that came to Egypt around the year 642, it nearly destroyed Christianity in Egypt. Because Christianity in Egypt had been weakened by decades of fighting amongst believers. And when the Islamic invaders came, at first, the Coptic Christians were relieved that they were no longer under the pressure of the Byzantine Roman Empire. You know, by 642, the Roman Empire in the West had been conquered by the barbarians, but the Roman Empire in the East, centered in Constantinople, which we know today as modern-day Istanbul, that Byzantine Roman Empire still had enormous influence in the formerly Western part of the Roman Empire. And the Coptic Christians felt that they were under the thumb, that they were being abused and mistreated by these Byzantine rulers centered in Constantinople. So they were initially relieved when the Muslims came and conquered the area, but their relief turned out to be far worse than their original problem. The Arab conquerors used very heavy taxation and other threats to persuade these Coptic Christians to become Muslims. And the effective use of these tactics prompted mass conversions by a lot of people. By about 1100 AD, Arabic had replaced Coptic as the common language of Egypt, to show how significant of a change it was there with the coming of Islam and the long entrenchment of Islam there in Egypt over the centuries. Now, I want to talk to you next about a couple of trends in Egyptian Christianity that really helped shape it in its own existence, but also in the way that it was perceived by the outside world. And one of these trends was the trend towards, and friend, you will have to forgive me, because this is a word that I always see on the page and have a great deal of difficulty pronouncing. I'm going to try to do it slow, but I'm going to be repeating this word often in this part of the lecture. And I just ask for your grace, because there's no doubt that I will be mispronouncing it many times. But I'm not going to try to be waylaid by that. I want to talk to you about the trend in Egyptian Christianity towards monophysitism. Monophysitism. I'm just going to go with that pronunciation the best I can. Now, in the year 451, the Council of Chalcedon proclaimed that Jesus Christ is one person with two natures, that he's fully God and fully man. Now, they didn't just kind of make this up because they felt like it. After so much discussion, debate, study, analysis, they really believed that this most reflected an accurate biblical teaching about who Jesus was. They weren't creating the idea that Jesus was one person with two natures. They weren't creating the idea that Jesus was fully God and fully man. They were simply observing and understanding it from the scriptures. But they thought that it needed to be stated very clearly, and that's what the Council of Chalcedon did in 451. Again, the proclamation that Jesus is one person with two natures, fully God and fully man. And that is the orthodox teaching of Christianity to this day. And the Council of Chalcedon condemned the view of the Eutyches, that was a group, who taught that Christ only has one divine nature. Again, this is the understanding, the doctrine that we would call monophysites, Those are the one nature people. Mono meaning one, physites, again, referring to nature. That's the idea that Jesus had one divine nature, not a human nature and a divine nature. And that specific understanding of the nature of Jesus was condemned at the Council of Chalcedon. Well, here's how that impacts Egyptian and then also Ethiopian Christianity. Most of, or maybe I should say much of, Egyptian and Ethiopian Christianity agreed with what was condemned at the Council of Chalcedon. In fact, one of the reasons, or at least some of the reason, for the Council of Chalcedon was the great concern that Christians in other parts of the world had about the embrace that the Egyptian bishops gave to the monophysite understanding of the nature of Jesus. Now again, I want to remind you, I'll repeat myself here. Monophysite essentially means one nature. And the monophysites believed that the humanity of Jesus was swallowed up by his deity. They believed that Jesus did not truly have a human nature. The Council of Chalcedon affirmed that Jesus had two natures, human and divine, and that these natures existed, this was some of the phrasing they used, without confusion, without change, individually and inseparably. Now, the organizers of the Council of Chalcedon hoped that this definition would unify Christianity as it existed all around the Roman Empire. But instead, at least in Egypt, the effect was more like an explosion. Large areas of the East would not accept the declaration of the Council of Chalcedon, such as the Coptic churches in Egypt and Ethiopia. The Eastern church was split in two, and the breakaway churches, again called the monophysite or the one nature churches, those churches that formed, some of them exist to this day, although after the Muslim invasions of the 7th century, there wasn't much strength in those monophysite churches. So this was something that took much of Egyptian Christianity and sort of put it outside of a lot of Western Christianity. You could see where much of Christianity in the West viewed Christianity in Egypt with suspicion, thinking, you guys believe wrong things about the nature of Jesus. You could also see that even within Eastern Christianity, that the Coptics had their own understanding, or at least many of the Coptics, it wasn't universal among them, but many of the Coptics had their own understanding that separated them even from other believers in the Eastern or Byzantine Empire of Christianity, that region there, dominating the eastern part of the former broad Roman Empire. So this was an important development that tended to fragment and isolate Egyptian Christianity from the rest of the Christian world. However, Egyptian Christianity did have a very significant influence on the rest of the world, the rest of the Christian world, let's say, through the person that is often considered to be the greatest monk or the greatest monk of Egypt, this man named Anthony. Now, Anthony, I'll tell you a little bit about his story, but just to say that he's often considered to be the greatest monk who ever lived. You know how it is in sports, in modern day football all over the world, people want to argue about who the greatest football player is. You know, at times people say, well, it's Ronaldo. Oh, it's Messi. Oh, it's somebody else. It's this person or that person. Who is the greatest football player of all time? Or who is the greatest football player in the present day? Well, some people would consider Anthony to be the greatest monk who there ever was. Now, the monastic movement went far beyond Egypt, and I'm going to discuss the monastic movement in greater detail in some later lectures. Yet it's very important to note that the monastic movement shaped Christianity in Egypt to a very large extent. The birthplace of the Christian monastic movement lies, you could say, underneath the Coptic cross-topped towers of St. Anthony's Monastery. That's 100 miles southeast of Cairo, you know, maybe 160 kilometers. The monastery's centerpiece is the Apostle Church, and that dates back to the early 15th century. But like many churches of that period, it was built upon the foundations of a much earlier church, maybe even back to the time of St. Anthony himself. What you'll find in those old excavations are small rooms for monks that date back to the 4th century. Again, perhaps to the very lifetime of Anthony of Egypt, the man who was considered the first Christian monk. He died around 356 or 357, and many people consider Anthony of Egypt to be the greatest monk there ever was. They also called him Anthony of the Desert, and he was an illiterate, reclusive man. Nevertheless, he gained a reputation across the entire Mediterranean world. Not only simple people admired him, but also sophisticated and influential people sought out him for his life and his wisdom. You could say that his words and his life inspired fellow Christians to greater devotion, and sometimes it even moved pagan people to convert to Christianity. But it wasn't his eloquence or his wisdom that amazed people as much as it was his radical devotion to Jesus Christ. Anthony was born in AD 251. He was an ethnic Egyptian. We would call him Coptic, if you want to, from that stock. At that time, Egyptian was still under Roman control, and Christians were still subject to occasional bouts of persecution. But Egyptian was also home, to one of the most energetic, life-filled Christian communities in the Roman Empire. And it had already produced two of Christianity's greatest minds, Clement of Alexandria and Origen. Many Egyptians who had a lot of wealth and influence found their way into the church. Now, that was exactly the situation with the parents of Anthony. They were well-born, they were prosperous, and they raised Anthony in the faith. Anthony regularly attended church with his parents, and he had no interest in learning how to read or speak Greek or Latin, only his native Coptic language. Nevertheless, early on, he's shown a very real interest in learning to hear the scriptures and hearing the scriptures read. So when Anthony was between 18 and 20, two events took place that changed the direction of his life. First, both his parents died, possibly of the plague. Anthony now found himself caring for his younger sister and a family estate of over 200 acres. That's more than 80 hectares. So the second event that took place was about 6 months later. One Sunday, as Anthony made his way to the church, now again, just remember, this man couldn't read, he couldn't write. He had no interest in reading or writing Latin or Greek, and he really hadn't learned how to read in his later in his native language of the Coptic language. But of course, he knew how to understand it. He was well-skilled as a hearer of the scriptures. As Anthony made his way to church, he was thinking about the biblical passage that describes in the book of Acts chapter 4 about how the early Christians sold their possessions and gave everything that they had to the poor. Again, that's in the later part of Acts chapter 4. He's thinking about that when he stepped into the church. A passage from the Gospels was being read, and Anthony heard these words: "If you would be perfect, go and sell all that you have and give to the poor, and come and follow me, and you shall have treasure in heaven." So he's thinking about this passage from Acts chapter 4 where Christians sold what they had and shared with another. And then he walks into church and that passage from Matthew chapter 19, verse 21 is being read. Well, Anthony was, of course, startled by this. He said it was as if the passage were read on his account. He believed strongly, this is being spoken to me personally. And he acted upon that. Anthony donated his huge family estate to the town where he lived. And he either sold or gave away the rest of everything that he owned. He put his little sister in the care of a convent. And then he said, I'm going to devote my life to pursuing Jesus through the spiritual disciplines instead of giving my attention to taking care of a large household estate. Now, the spiritual disciplines that Anthony meant were the things like constant prayer, manual labor, long periods of fasting, and forced watches through the night without sleep. He joined with a Christian hermit who lived nearby, and then he started visiting many hermits. In his work, The Life of Saint Anthony, Athanasius wrote this. He observed the graciousness of one, the eagerness for prayers in another. He took careful note of one's freedom from anger and the human concern of another. He admired one for patience and another for fastings and sleeping on the ground. He marked likewise the piety towards Christ and the mutual love of them all. You see, through observing the lives of these many monks, Anthony determined to outdo all of them in the performance of these spiritual disciplines. Athanasius continues, his watchfulness was such that he often passed the entire night without sleep. And doing this not once, but often, he inspired wonder. He ate once daily after sunset, but there were times when he received food every second and frequently even every fourth day. His food was bread and salt, and drinking he took only water. A rush mat was sufficient for him to sleep, but more regularly he lay on the bare ground. So you can see Anthony has this habit of staying up all night to pray through the night, depriving himself sleep, fasting oftentimes. And when he did eat, he would give himself only very simple food, bread and salt. When it came to what he would drink, he would only drink water. At night, he would sleep not on a nice soft mattress, but on a very thin mat or maybe even on the bare ground. Now, sometimes people consider Anthony to be the founder of the monastic movement. He's not. He wasn't the first monk. But he put monasticism on the Christian map because of the very extraordinary practice of monastic discipline that he lived in his life. Early and later medieval Christians understood the spiritual life, oftentimes in terms of how Anthony practiced these things. You could say that Anthony was considered the best monk when it came to the spiritual disciplines that there ever was. You see, Anthony believed, as did most of the Christians of his time, that the soul intensity is strong when the bodily pleasures are weakened. In other words, if you want to have a strong soul, then you have to deny your body pleasures. So he said, if your body is well rested, if it's satisfied with pleasures, if you're enjoying good food and the good things of this life, you're going to become spiritually lazy. Basically, Anthony had the perspective, no pain, no gain. Now, there weren't many people who matched the radical discipline that Anthony showed, but even those who didn't recognize the need to discipline themselves as much as he did, they felt that they needed to do something. Anthony impressed many of the townspeople around him, but he remained unsatisfied with the progress he was making. So what did he do? Well, instead of afflicting himself in these ways, he moved some distance from the village. He found an abandoned tomb, and he started to live there. He arranged for a friend to bring him bread, and then he closed the entrance to the tomb, and he lived encased in this tomb for a long time. Now, while Anthony lived in that tomb, he says that he experienced some terrible demonic attacks. He described the attacks and his victory over those demonic spirits and the sense of God's blessing and approval that he gained through all of that. Through the years, he ended up leaving that tomb and moving even further away from civilization, and he lived in a long abandoned fortress. He shut himself in the fortress, again, after making arrangements for the delivery of food, and he began to live there all alone. Well, with this, his reputation grew greater still, so that over the years, more and more people journeyed to this fortress in hopes of catching a sight of this man who had become a hero in the minds of many people. Other people received counsel, speaking to him through the gate of the fortress, because for many, many years, Anthony never left the fortress. And many people who were inspired by his example took up the discipline themselves. They went off to some lonely place and started living in great isolation and afflicting themselves, body and soul, thinking that it would bring them closer to God. Anthony lived in this abandoned fortress for 20 years. And then after 20 years, he left the fortress, and then a crowd of people was waiting for him outside. According to the accounts, after 20 years of living on hardly any food and, you know, in terrible conditions, when he left the fortress, he looked healthy and well. This is what they said of him when he left. Again, this is from Athanasius and his Life of Anthony. They said, "The state of his soul was one of purity, for it was not constricted by grief, nor relaxed by pleasure. Moreover, when he saw the crowd, he was not annoyed any more than he was elated at being embraced by so many people." With that, departing from that fortress where he had stayed for 20 years, Anthony began what we might call his public ministry. Athanasius reports that he healed the sick, that he exorcised demons, that he reconciled enemies, that he comforted the mourning, and he gave grace in speech, talking for hours with those who sought spiritual direction. He was the inspiration for founding many monasteries, and he influenced and guided them. For the rest of his life, Anthony moved back and forth between monastic seclusion and public ministry, not only in the desert, but also in the city. When Roman persecution rose again in the year 311, Anthony continued to appear in public. The authorities refused to touch him. They were probably afraid that if they were to make a martyr out of him, it would outrage the public, both the Christians and the pagans. When that time of persecution was over, Anthony eventually went about 100 miles, again, that's 160 kilometers, southeast of Cairo. Anthony was about 40 by this time, and he spent the next 65 years, he lived to the age 105, he spent the next 65 years with this as his home base. Anthony's remarkable devotion and longevity enhanced his reputation for being a very holy man. Athanasius records a number of remarkable stories from this period. And as people who like to talk about history, it's hard to figure out what is true and what is a legend in these many stories, But Athanasius tells many stories about Athanasius during these years. By the time Anthony was 105 years old, his body was frail, his teeth were completely gone, and he knew that he was going to die soon. So he told his companions what to do with all of his possessions. He encouraged his followers, and he died. He insisted on being buried in an unmarked grave. Nobody knows to this day where he was buried. Well, here's the thing. More than any other individual, this ethnically Egyptian man, Anthony, inspired the monastic movement. He wasn't the first monk, but he was the most influential monk in the beginning of the monastic movement. You could say that indirectly, he was responsible for the evangelization and the Christianizing of Europe because of his mighty influence on the monastic movement, which became the institution that did more to evangelize and Christianize Europe than any other institution. This was a very ironic part of the legacy of an illiterate Egyptian man who wanted to live far from civilization for most of his life. Now, what are we to make of Anthony and his desire to afflict himself, his desire to punish himself, his feeling that this made him a more holy man? Well, I'm going to delay the discussion of that question until we deal more properly with the monastic movement as a whole. This lecture, we're just talking about Anthony because he's a reflection of the Egyptian branch and the Egyptian influence on the rest of Christianity through a man like Anthony, but we're going to leave it there. Now, let me conclude with this, just speaking for a short bit about early Christianity in Ethiopia. One could say that the story of Christianity in Ethiopia begins with Candace. Candace was a queen of Ethiopia, the one mentioned in Acts chapter 8, verse 27, in the story of Philip preaching the gospel to the Ethiopian eunuch, who was the queen's treasurer. Tradition tells us that Queen Candace was converted to Christ through that eunuch's testimony when he came back to Ethiopia, and that her conversion caused her to use her position as queen to promote Christianity in Ethiopia and the surrounding countries. She and her husband reigned in Ethiopia from AD 25 to 41. Now, historically speaking, the story of the acceptance of Christianity in this East African empire of Ethiopia dates from the 4th century. Two men, Frumentius and Edesius, they both came from Tyre, that's on the coast of modern Lebanon. These two men, Frumentius and Edesius, were taken as prisoners to Ethiopia, which was also called Abyssinia. While there, they were able to gain the favor of Emperor Ezana and were set free. What did they do when they were set free? Well, they began to evangelize the country. And by about the year 340, Frumentius was consecrated the bishop of Ethiopia by Athanasius in Alexandria. The Christian influence in Ethiopia grew until the entrance and conquest of Islamic influence. As it began to spread in Africa, the church was cut off with contact with other Christians, except for the Coptic church in Egypt. So, let me summarize what we can say about African Christianity in this early period of the Christian church. Christianity came early to Egypt, Ethiopia, and North Africa. That's number one. Number two, Christianity in Egypt was associated with the Monophysites. This was an error regarding the humanity and the deity of Jesus. Third, Christianity in Egypt was associated with monasticism, the monks, especially because of Anthony, an extremely influential monk. Fourth, Christianity was dominant in Egypt and especially in North Africa for more than 500 years until the conquest from Islam. And then finally, the evangelization of sub-Saharan Africa waited for coming centuries. It really didn't happen in this early church period or in the period immediately following the early church period. So I hope this has been helpful for you. I hope you join us for further lectures on the early church as we continue on down the timeline of church history.